On Monday, the U.S. Supreme Court started its new term after a three-month hiatus. The lineup of cases includes voting maps, gun restrictions for people convicted of domestic abuse, and some cases that could limit the power of the federal government and regulators. Christine Chabot is an associate professor of law at Marquette University. Christine, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Before we start digging into particular cases, Christine, it's been a kind of a wild couple of years with the Supreme Court, some very big cases that overturned precedent. Attention to ethical issues. Are things calming down this time around, or are we ready for another wild ride?
So I think many listeners might expect things to calm down, but in fact, we are in for another wild ride with many blockbuster cases. And there are really two reasons why this is the case. First of all, the court has taken a trio of decisions or cases that are poised to take a wrecking ball to the administrative state. I think for most listeners, the administrative state probably flies under the radar. We don't often think about the many ways in which administrative agencies' regulations touch many aspects of our daily lives, but in fact, they're very, very important. So if you think about regulations governing the purity of the water we drink and the air we breathe, access to drugs like abortion medication, mifepristone, or regulation of important financial products like mortgages and student loans. All of those are subject to regulations. And this term, the Supreme Court is going to decide a trio of cases with potential to dramatically cut back on this type of regulatory authority. A second reason why the case that the court is going to decide this term might be blockbusters, and the fact that that's surprising is that if you're a careful observer of the Roberts Court, you might expect them to try and do what they often like to do and proceed incrementally, try to space out some of their important rulings. But really, in this case, the Roberts Court is losing control over its docket. The Fifth Circuit is going to force its hand, and essentially has forced its hand, by declaring a number of federal statutes and federal agency structures unconstitutional. So at this point, the Supreme Court has no choice but to take and review those cases and review many of them in the same term.
All right. We hear different circuit courts having reputations as being particularly liberal in some cases, particularly conservative in others. Can you shine a light on the Fifth Circuit and the reputation it has and the kind of cases it's advancing?
Yes, the Fifth Circuit is known as a very conservative court, and I'd also say that it tends to rule in a very maximalist way. So it takes conservative arguments and pushes them to their logical extreme in many cases, and that's why we're seeing so many decisions in which the Fifth Circuit is declaring federal statutes or federal agency structures unconstitutional. Sometimes it seems like every time I turn around, there's a new decision from the Fifth Circuit holding that another structure is unconstitutional.
Let's dig into some of those administrative state cases. They're not getting as much attention, I think, out there in the media. Now, one, they've already argued the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau there's a lawsuit over it saying it's unconstitutional. This is brought by payday lenders, in effect. Tell us a little bit about this case and what's at stake.
So this case could take out a major watchdog in the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. And it's really for that reason a blockbuster with potential to have some of the most wide-ranging consequences of any case that the court is going to decide this term. It arises from a Fifth Circuit decision declaring unconstitutional the funding structure of a major executive branch regulator, again, the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. And the Fifth Circuit's ruling suggests that everything the Bureau has done is unconstitutionally funded and therefore unlawful. If the Supreme Court agrees, it will take out a leading regulator and potentially destabilize the financial sector. So huge consequences in this case. And I'll turn now to the constitutional issue, which turns on the Appropriations Clause. In particular, the issue is whether this clause requires Congress to pass funding laws that impose relatively specific limits on the amount and duration of funding for executive branch agencies like the Bureau. And the Bureau's challengers argue that Congress has essentially handed off its power of the purse by passing an open-ended funding law in this circumstance. The problem, though, with this argument is that the so-called limits that the challengers urge aren't apparent from the text of the Constitution. The text only requires appropriations made by law. It seems like Congress fulfilled that requirement here. Further, at oral argument, Justice Kagan pointed out that the supposed constitutional limits being raised fly in the face of over 250 years of historical practice. And based on my own research, I can confirm that these types of open-ended spending laws do, in fact, date back to the founding. So for these reasons, I think many justices seem skeptical of the constitutional challenges to the Bureau's funding.
And do even the conservative justices, were they showing skepticism? Because that they're the ones with the majority.
Right. And definitely, I think there was skepticism voiced from Justice Barrett and Justice Kavanaugh during argument, as well as skepticism voiced from Justice Jackson, Justice Sotomayor, and Justice Kagan. So it's possible that we would at least have a majority deciding to reverse the Fifth Circuit and declaring the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau's funding constitutional.
Talking to Christine Chabot, Associate Professor of Law at Marquette University, looking at a new term in the U.S. Supreme Court. We've been talking about some cases, maybe not at the top of the radar. They're looking at the administrative state regulations, big impact, as she says. Christine, I want to turn to some of the other high-profile cases. Now, one on gun control, having to do with people convicted of domestic violence, whether they can, or sorry, excuse me, people under domestic violence restraining orders, whether they can purchase a firearm. Now, this hinges on a past ruling authored by Justice Clarence Thomas that said on Second Amendment cases, in effect, judges need to be historians and go back and see if over a time period early in American history, there were comparable laws on the books. If there weren't, I think the argument is then you can't have laws. Can you talk about this case and how it fits into that?
Yes. So this is U.S. versus Rahimi, and it does raise really important Second Amendment issues, and especially how courts are now going to apply the Second Amendment test that was articulated in the Bruin case, which does require courts to apply an originalist historical lens, and that originalist historical lens is to be the exclusive measure of whether a particular restriction on gun possession is constitutional. And this case, again, stems from another Fifth Circuit ruling finding this federal statute prohibiting possession of firearms by persons subject to domestic restraining orders unconstitutional. So here, the kind of framework applied in Bruin essentially requires the government to show that there is an analog, a historical analog, supporting a very similar gun restriction to the type of gun restriction they are trying to show is lawful here. And that's a very difficult test for the government to meet in some of these cases. In fact, in the Fifth Circuit decision, it seemed to apply this test in a way that probably be almost impossible for the government to win. It seemed like it needed to show a carbon copy or a precise historical analog for the law at issue regulating gun possession by people that are found to be risks for domestic violence. And problematic, I thought, in the Fifth Circuit's ruling was that it was ready to distinguish several founding era laws that did limit guns for certain categories of persons deemed dangerous. They just said there weren't persons deemed dangerous in quite the same way as the current law deems people who are subject to domestic restraining orders dangerous, and therefore we can't find this law to be constitutional. So I think this is revealing that the Bruin test is one that is proving to be very difficult for courts to apply in practice, and it's one that's going to be very difficult for the government to win because it's very difficult in many cases to show that the current law you have is going to be the carbon copy or has a very close analog in the historical record. So as applied, this test seems to potentially make it impossible for legislatures to adopt innovative solutions to emerging firearm-related dangers.
Another case, and this I think we're going to see maybe a lot of things like this. This has to do with social media, and that's the courts are, I think, slowly catching up with how this works. We've got a couple states, Texas and Florida, saying, hey, we're going to pass state laws that limits the ability of a social media service provider, say a Facebook or a Twitter, sorry, X or what have you. We're going to limit their ability to take people off of the service, to moderate their accounts. The laws each work a little differently. Now, here comes this challenge to this. What ends up being at stake here in this case?
So these are major First Amendment challenges to laws in Florida and Texas that do try to restrict social media platforms in how they engage in content moderation. And one of the key points here, I think, is that the social media platforms are not just passively posting whatever content different users like to post on those platforms. They're engaging in some content moderation. And I think the laws are concerned with and aimed at concerns that some of these platforms are maybe discriminating against certain types of messages or users of the platforms, and conservatives' speech or conservative people on these platforms are not getting the same access to or having their messages circulated as freely as other speakers on the platform. So that's what the laws are designed to regulate. But the problem from the First Amendment perspective is that the platforms themselves are engaging in communicative actions when they curate social media posts. They're engaging in speech that's protected by the First Amendment. Indeed, some of the restrictions, I think, may also regulate the content of the social media platform speech by saying you must make sure that you don't, for example, eliminate anyone who is a politician or is engaging in political speech. So that's beyond regulating speech, telling these platforms what type of content they need to put on their platforms. So both of those facts, that there's speech regulation and potential content-based regulation, mean that the laws need to meet a higher level of scrutiny to pass muster under the First Amendment. So to win these cases, the states would need to show that their laws are narrowly drawn to further a substantial or compelling government interest. And here there's a circuit split. The 11th Circuit suggested that Florida's law was unconstitutional restriction on the First Amendment or free speech, and the 5th Circuit suggested that Texas's law was not. So it will be up to the Supreme Court to resolve that split this term.
A lot to watch over the coming months. Christine, thanks again for joining us today.
Thanks so much.
That's Christine Chabot, Associate Professor of Law at Marquette University. We talked to her about the new U.S. Supreme Court term and some cases to keep an eye on over the coming months.